If God was here and we said, Lord, what's the best way to do evangelism? I think he'd say, why don't you go through the books I've given you about my son?
Hello, and welcome to Working with me, Dan Doriani, hosting a podcast where we explore faith, work, culture, and the way believers can make a difference in their corner of the world. My guest today, I'm so glad to have Rico Tice, who's an Anglican clergyman. In America, we would say he's a pastor. He's in the Church of England, and he is ministering in one of the great churches of England, All Souls Church in London, famed as the place where John Stott ministered for many years and as a lighthouse for the gospel. So that's your work in a word, but you do have a very interesting history. You're a man of the world. You were born in Chile. You grew up in Uganda and Zaire. You live in the UK, and you didn't grow up in a Christian home at all. You grew up in a non-Christian tobacco family, and your dad and mom somehow decided to send you to a Christian school where you converted, a mission school. So I believe when you were in Africa. So why don't you give us just a couple minutes about how you came to faith and your background and what language do you dream in?
Yeah. Well, certainly the only schools around, if you were an expat working in Africa, were mission schools. So I got sent to a mission school as a little boy, and I think I was prayed for there. But I became a Christian at a boarding school 10 years after that, when I was 15, 16. But I'm convinced it was the prayers of those missionaries that were then answered. And the school I came to faith in, there were probably 15 of us that were born again Christians in the entire school of 650 boys. So it was amazing that the Lord chose me and put his hand on me. And again, it was a providence that I was sent to that mission school and prayed for the first time, which was in Uganda. So dad was growing tobacco there, and that was the first school I went to. And I know they were missionaries, and I know they prayed.
Yes. For what it's worth, I was a professor at a Christian school in which probably more than half of all the students were non-Christians. And I guarantee you, we were praying for the students, and many of them did become Christians. I think a better ratio than what you experienced. And that was certainly difficult, being one of just a handful in a very large school, 15 of 650. That's a tiny percentage.
Yeah, well, brother, it's amazing. But, it really taught me that the Christian life's a fight.
Yes.
I think any of your listeners, we can easily forget this. Jesus says, take up your cross and follow me. And very quickly after coming to faith, now partly I was arrogant and outspoken, so I regret the lack of gentleness, but the level of opposition made me understand that this isn't just flesh and blood. There is a spiritual battle.
Right.
There were magazines written against the Christians each month that would come out.
Yeah.
Called Lordy Lordy. So I'd walk into the dining room and know that everyone had read this magazine. It was just a malicious attack. But what it did was I'm so grateful for it now as I look back, because in God's sovereignty, it toughened me up for the fact the Christian faith's a battle.
Yeah. And that's something you hit repeatedly in the book that I have in front of me, Honest Evangelism.
Yes.
Which is a remarkably honest book. And, practically the first page, you say, witnessing, evangelizing is nerve-wracking. It's painful. You will get hit. You'll be rejected. And I'm sure that comes out of your many experiences, but probably beginning when you were a teenager.
Yes. And now the first thing to say is, let's get our tone right. So
yes.
I think sometimes I didn't, and I deserved
yes.
a bit of a knockback. But I think I learned that to be loving. But nevertheless, people feel sometimes the Lord Jesus, it's the smell of death, and to the other, it's the aroma of life. So it is a spiritual battle. And therefore, what I'd say to the listeners is, we have to have our identity in the gospel. So whether I accept or reject you doesn't make me valuable. What makes me valuable is Christ died for me, and I've got to have my value there. Otherwise, I'll say something and I'll be knocked back, which the parable of the sower tells me there'll be lots of rejection. I won't be ready for it, and then I'll stop doing evangelism. I've just got to realize that being rejected is part of this. It is what Jesus promised us. But at the same time, it's amazing when people hear and come to faith.
Yes. Somehow I'm reminded of a Bible study. I taught a Bible study called Lunch with Skeptics. And the principle is very simple. We would go through maybe Luke or Romans, or some other, you know, basic, easy to understand gospel driven book. And I got to talk the first 5 minutes, and I got to talk the last 5 minutes, and you had to be a non-Christian to come, or bring a non-Christian to come, one or the other. And it was interesting. I mean, a lot of people came to faith, but, you know, people also definitely rejected. And one person said, I can't, you know, came one time, and his friend said, what do you think? He said, well, I think if I ever come again, I might become a Christian so I can never come again.
Oh, brother. Yeah. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's on the edge. It's on the edge of eternity.
Yeah.
And I think we've just got to be prepared for delay and disappointment. That's what the parable of the sower tells us. And that, you know, Mark chapter 4, you know, that the seed grows night and day with you know, it, and we're often, we live in an instant culture.
Yes.
So we want instant results. It takes a long time. Mm. And there's going to be disappointment, you know. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? There's John the Baptist teaching Herod. He goes up to the Herod's palace in Mark chapter 6. He preaches, and then halfway through the course, his time in prison, as he's been preaching that day, you know, Salome does a stupid dance.
Right.
Herod's half drunk, and suddenly John gets his head chopped off. Now, that's disappointing. Well, yeah. And that's the guy he's witnessing to. Now, but we're being told,
yes,
you've got to be ready for rejection. Now, be gracious, be loving, but please understand rejection's part of it. And often we think we're doing something wrong. We're not. It's just the nature of evangelism.
Yeah. And of course, that episode is shortly before Jesus starts talking repeatedly about his own death and resurrection.
Yeah.
So it foreshadows the fact that Jesus, of course, paid with his life, and that was by God's design, but it's also because people were hostile and envious and didn't like the way he was upsetting things, their life, their status. And if we say John did nothing wrong, Jesus certainly did nothing wrong, and he was hated for it.
And it was very interesting, John Stott, he said when he was at All Souls, he said, look, extraordinarily, and this is very unusual in Christian history, we have been evangelical, orthodox, and loved here in central London by the culture. You know, Billy Graham was an amazing influence. The Queen was a real Christian woman. Yes. But Uncle John, before he died, said, the question is, will we remain faithful to the gospel over the next 50 years when we're going to be hated?
Yeah.
And I think a lot of churches and pastors just aren't ready for the hate, and therefore they're just not prepared. And particularly here over human sexuality,
right,
in Britain, over whether we're calling everyone who has sex outside marriage, whether gay or straight, to repent. That's what we're being hated for.
Right. We're perceived as being fun-hating, you know, an expressivist culture. People just want to express who they are, and they want to live for pleasure. And when we say you shouldn't do what feels good right now, we just seem like hateful people. And they think they have every right to hate us. They think they properly hate Christians.
What's extraordinary is the number in our church who are converted out of a gay lifestyle. So they're same-sex acted celibate Christians. And we're the only safe place for them. So when people say we're homophobic, we say, hold on, this is nuanced. What about these people who love Jesus and living faithfully? Him, know he knows what's best, but they have these inclinations they're battling, and we're the only safe place. So it's quite important to say that, I think, as we defend our orthodoxy.
Yes.
But nevertheless, I look at the churches around All Souls. One was the church Whitfield preached in.
Yes.
Another was a wonderfully faithful church, and I see how the pastors have capitulated to the culture, and it is simply because they fear man more than they fear God.
Well, that's unfortunately exactly right in many, many settings. So, Rico, as you know, this is a podcast on faith and work. So let me do something and ask you to comment in ways that would help people who are listening, who are, you know, engineers and business managers and transportation folk. One of the things you note in your book is that your father, who was a successful businessman, told you at one point, you know, son, you're a number two, not a number one. Don't try to be a number one. And you comment that you have dyslexia, which you've overcome to, you know, become very articulate and an author. But you agreed with his analysis that you're not supposed to be a number one. At All Souls, you're on the staff. You're not the lead pastor. And I found it very interesting in your biography. It also says that you are, you know, you're skilled in rugby. You were a captain at rugby at one point in your school. And you are a non-executive director of an organization called Christians in Sport. I just love that. It fits with you being a number two. You're a non-executive director. Tell us, what does it mean to be very talented and very driven, energetic, and yet not aspire to be the leader, aspire to be number two or even number three?
Well, the first thing is, I think that, I knew my dad really loved me. Mm. He's a lovely dad. He came to faith late in his life. Actually, from Deuteronomy 8, 16 and 17, you may say, my power and the strength of my hands have produced this wealth for me. Remember the Lord your God, it's he who produces, gives you the ability to produce wealth. So that verse really convicted him that it was all from God. But dad loved me, and you've got to let the people that love you speak into your life. And he just said, look, I've been managing people for 40 years, and Rico, you're a number two. I think the reason for that is that with my dyslexia, I'm not very good at juggling things. Mm. I tend to, if I've got a talk, I had a talk this evening, I can't really think about much else except that talk for the day. Now, very good leaders, as I've looked at the number ones, are amazing, it seems to me, at just being able to spin from one thing to another to another. And certainly my boss here at All Souls is, and the previous two were as well. They could just juggle and spin plates. And it's realizing that I'm just not very good at that.
Mm. And there's nothing wrong with being a number two, right? And you're very gifted, and God's given you great fruit in your labor.
Yes, I think two things are key to that. The first is that if you can't respect your boss, that does make it hard.
Right.
But the second is, if you do respect him, you've got to be loyal, which means you don't, if you disagree, you privately do that to him, but publicly he's got to know you're loyal.
Right.
And our bosses know whether we're loyal or not. My boss here at Charlie, he just knows that they can tell whether people are speaking behind their back or not, or whether they're supporting them. And I think the devil can get in when bosses don't think we're loyal. But at the same time, you've got to have a place to privately disagree and say, look, can I say that? But then you have a choice of either, I guess, to leave or to get behind them. And
right.
What I've had to do is, now my present boss is 10 years younger than me, is submit and be loyal to him. Now, that doesn't mean if something's really ungodly happening, I'm not going to say something. And we've all got to, like Daniel, have a line that we draw. Daniel 1:8, Daniel resolved not to eat the king's food.
Right.
Yeah, I think if I can respect the boss, I've got to be loyal. And if I can't respect him and can't be loyal, I think that's a problem for
me. Yes, well said. And that applies to everybody in every field. And that applies to number twos and number threes. It might not apply to somebody who's just hired last week. They don't necessarily have access to a boss.
And if you're a boss, you're under God's authority. So you're a servant too.
Yes.
I think that did that. And how is servanthood shown in companies? It's by the tiny gestures. So you remember the name or the birthday of the secretary.
Yes.
You are aware if someone's parent is ill and you flip them a text. It's like church life. Tiny gestures mean so much. And having a notebook and remembering and then just connecting and saying, it's just such an encouragement that people are, then they're not a human resource, they're a human being, because you're remembering the tiny gesture.
Right.
And that takes time, and that's hard because you're under pressure time-wise.
Thanks for your comments on being number two. And Rico, would you please tell us how you got involved in evangelism in the first place? You told us about high school, but your experience is like that of many other people. My own experience, not that I'm going to go into it now, but as you work, you find out that you have skills you didn't know you had. And someone gives you something and it becomes a task that you like or dislike, but sometimes it becomes your life's work. How did you come to be an evangelist at All Souls?
Well, I think beginning with evangelism, it was two things. First of all, because I came from a non-Christian home, the people I buried, now I leave them in God's hands, Dan, but I don't have hope for them. I leave them with the Lord. I'm not going to say they're in hell. It's up for the Lord to do that. But the reality was that they believed in their own goodness.
Right.
As my grandmother died, she said, because I'm a good person, God will accept me. Well, why did God send his son to die if your goodness is good enough?
Right.
So the first thing is that I do believe Jesus is the most loving man that ever lived. And he's telling the truth when he says, I've come to save you from hell through the cross for heaven. And And so my loved ones, the people I loved most, were not Christian when they died. And I remember watching my brother break down at my grandmother's funeral as he did a reading. And I was the only one in the church that knew why. So I think that's the first thing. You get propelled by the knowledge of loved ones, you know, that school, you know, 635 of the 650 boys were very pleased with themselves. You know, the English, the great disease of the English, Dan, is this self-righteousness that we've got. Mm. Actually, dear old Prince Harry's punctured that a bit. I think that, you know, with what where he's going, but, you know, I don't know. But you know, there's this terrible self-righteousness. They think that because they're good, God will accept them. It's the exact reverse of the gospel. So first of all, I was compelled by the reality of hell. I believe Jesus was talking about that. I think he died to save us, and I think people were going there. And it was a right thing that God judged. But secondly, then once you start, the other side of it is, and I'd really say this to your listeners, Dan, is that there's joy in finding the lost. So Luke 15, yes. You know, the lost coin, when it's found, there's rejoicing. The lost yes. sheep, there's rejoicing. The son comes home, there's a party. And yes. so I found that the Holy Spirit gave me great joy. Even when people rejected it, I'd be going, this is on the edge of eternity. This is the Super Bowl every day.
But you know, the best thing when somebody rejects indicates at least often that they're thinking about it. Indifference yeah. is actually the worst. And yeah. hostility and fighting back indicates that somehow it's gotten under their skin.
Well, and you also know, because, you know, I'm an egotist. I love to know my life matters. But you also know that was the most important 5 minutes of their life as we had a chat about what they think. And so I just found it was so suffused with meaning. And then in God's kindness, of course, we must do this to be faithful. But when you do see people come to faith and you can see they're born again and they're beginning to battle sin and they're making choices that mean they can flourish, it's a lovely thing, isn't it? I mean, I've got a friend who's just flown to Australia. He works for the Foreign Office, but he came to faith when we were at Oxford together. I was becoming a vicar and doing terribly academically, but you know, I just see what a fine man he is. And it's a growing up Christian and his wife loves him. And I just know it's the way of flourishing. Jesus knows what's best. So I think it's those conflicting things. On the one hand, it's hell and the wonder of grace, the wonder of new life in Christ. All those things come together to make evangelism utterly captivating, I find, but at the same time, terrifying.
Yeah. And for the sake of our listeners, I'll point out that one reason, you know, why I wanted to interview you, and we don't have to comment on this, I want to move on to another topic for a second. But, you know, you point out in your book, Honest Evangelism, that you were assigned to follow up on people who came to church and said they wanted to talk to somebody. Now, I don't know how yes. prominent that was, but it's certainly, you know, in your book. And sometimes you find great joy in taking care of an assignment that's simply given to us.
And the other thing is, just in England on that one, is that, you know, the best evangelist we ever had was John Wesley, and we threw him out of the church.
Yes, right.
So we're now in a place, because we're not developing evangelists, just pastors, where it's evangelize or die.
Yes.
So if you love your church, just let me say to those listening, they're evangelists. They're those who do the work of the evangelist, and we're all to be witnesses. But we can all try and do the work of the evangelist. If you can start trying to train people to just get the gospel out, to say their prayers, to ask questions, to celebrate people, maybe have a little outline. Oh my goodness me, you're gold dust in the church.
Right.
Our churches aren't doing evangelism so often. And therefore, if you start saying, I'm going to try and do it personally and try and equip my fellow believers at my church, oh, it's just such a gift to the pastor and the leadership, let alone glorifying Jesus.
Well, we're going to take a break in a minute. We need to take a little break. But before we do, I'm going to set up our next question or our next topic I want you to talk about. And that is that you and I share a conviction that one of the best ways to evangelize is simply to read a book of the Bible together with somebody. And for you, yeah. Christianity Explored, it's the Gospel of Mark. When I meet with people, I let them choose anything they want as long as it's Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John.
Yeah, brilliant.
And then we go to lunch and we talk. And I loved it when you said in the book, you don't need to be an evangelist. You just need to be a Bible sharer. You don't need to be a Bible yeah. teacher. Just be a Bible sharer. Open yeah. up a passage of the Bible that you were reading maybe last week, a passage you dearly love, and share that with people. So we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back and talk about why you chose the Gospel of Mark as the pathway for people.
Hi, I'm John Perkins, Executive Director of the Center for Faith and Work St. Louis. You've been listening to our podcast, Working with Dan Doriani. The center also offers conferences on faith and work throughout the United States. Our goal is to equip formal and informal leaders to make a difference in their corner of the world. We equip Christian leaders to run 10-hour faith and work cohorts on three continents. Please visit our website at faithandworkstl.org to see how your church or organization can form a faith and work cohort for people who have, or aspire to, a leadership role in their workplace. Now, back to Dan.
So, Rico, why did you choose the Gospel of Mark? And by the way, you know, the system you use is not simply, you know, chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3.
Aye, that's right.
You start with the, just for our listeners, you start with the good news, then the identity of Jesus Christ, then sin, then the cross, then resurrection, then grace, last. And then you talk about the parable of sower. So why did you pick Mark? And then maybe a word on why you chose this order of events for people.
Yeah. So the first thing I'd say is that if God was here, and this is a really middle-class English arrogant thing to say, this is why in Hollywood the worst villains have my accent. But let me say something arrogant to all your listeners, and that is that if God was here and we said, Lord, what's the best way to do evangelism? I think he'd say, why don't you go through the books I've given you about my son?
Right.
Now, there are lots of ways to evangelism, but the best way is to say to someone, let's just look at the biographies together.
Right.
Now, I chose Mark, of course, because my main friends were rugby friends.
Yes.
And they're not great readers. It's the shortest.
It's brevity, right.
And it's like, if you went to a library, I think that Luke would be in history, Matthew and John would be in theology.
Yes.
But Mark would be in the racy novel. You know, Mark would be fast.
Yeah.
The first one that was written. And then the framework, you're right, you give the week by week, but the framework, the DNA of Mark's gospel, and this is what's amazing about it, Dan, is that the DNA of Mark's gospel is that every verse, just about every verse in Mark's gospel, is either about the identity of Jesus, who he is, or the mission of Jesus, why he came, or the call of Jesus, what it means to follow him. There is no book in the Bible that is written with such discipline. So, brother, let's just play a game here. If you give me a number between 1 and 16, give us a number, Dan.
9.
And give me a number between 1 and 35.
21.
Okay, if we turn to Mark 9:21, I mean, this is how we will see that it is either identity, mission, or call.
Yes.
So here we are. Let me read it. You Mark 9, verse 21, and we'll just see which one of the three it is. So here we go. So verse 21. So they brought him, this is the boy, when the Spirit saw Jesus, it immediately threw the boy into convulsions. He fell to the ground and rolled around, foaming at the mouth. Jesus asked, here's verse 21, the boy's father, how long has he been like this? From childhood, he answered. It has, verse 22, often thrown him into fire or water to kill him. But if you can do anything, take pity on us and help us. If you can, Jesus said, everything is possible for one who believes. Immediately the boy's father exclaimed, I do believe. Help me overcome my unbelief. When Jesus saw that a crowd was running to the scene, he rebuked the spirit. You deaf and mute spirit, he said, I command you, come out of him and never enter him again. The spirit shrieked, convulsed him, and violently came out. The boy looked so much like a corpse that many said he was dead. Now, that is identity.
Well, it's actually all three. You know that perfectly well.
Yes,
because Jesus is the one who can, right? You can do, and if you can, what do you mean if you can? The problem is not if I can, I have all power.
That's good.
And it's also mission because he's releasing this family from the power of demonic oppression and death.
Yeah, very good. Yeah.
And it's a call to discipleship because there's a whole crowd watching all this trying to make sense of Jesus' power.
I mean, that's very good, Dan. You've got all three there. I mean, if I'm doing this basically with a rugby player who's just looking at it, the one identity, I'd say, who is this that he's got power over evil?
Yeah.
And you're naive if you don't believe in evil, but here is Jesus with absolute authority over evil. So when it comes to the demonic world, who are you going to for protection? But this is who Jesus is. Now, and then, of course, the cross is how we get protected.
Right.
But what I'm saying is, brother, here is that whatever passage you'd have given me there, we'd have got crystal clear identity, mission, call. And then the fourth word, which makes it so dramatic, is blindness.
Mm.
So in every passage, someone can't see who he is, why he came, what it means to follow him. So, for example, in this passage, when the father says, I do believe, help me overcome my unbelief, he said, look, I'm a bit blind on this.
He actually
admitted blind. So, but in every passage, the drama is, who his identity, but can you, they can't see it, can you?
Right.
You know, the father can't believe, but can you believe?
Right.
And so it just makes reading Mark so exciting, but above all, so clear.
Well, there's always a gap between Jesus. So I haven't told you this, but I teach Gospels. I'm a professor. I teach Gospels.
Yeah,
so in the Gospel of Mark, there's almost always a gap with all the unbelief that you can slide into. You know, you watch Jesus in all this beauty, and then you have these dunderheads who can't understand what's going on or why. And, oh, my goodness, Jesus' disciples couldn't heal this kid. He must be powerless. What's wrong? And you go, come on, people. I mean, he just healed all these people in chapter 7. He healed a blind man, a deaf man, and fed 5,000. Yes, he has the power. What's wrong with you? And it's almost like Mark invites you to rebuke the unbelievers by stepping in and saying, guys, come on. Don't you see what's happening here?
Yeah. Well, and what's amazing when you read this individually, so for your listeners, can I just hold this out to you? Because all we are is holy page turners. We just turn the page, let the person have a look and say, well, who's blind, who can see, and is it identity, mission, or call? But I remember reading with one guy called Paul, and we were in Regent's Park, and we were looking at Mark chapter 4, the calming of the storm.
Mm.
And he said to me, he said, look, really, I just came to church because my sister said I needed a spiritual element in my life. So I said, well, look, let's have a look at Mark's gospel. And we read the passage and you know, the bit, the disciples go, who is this? You know, he can rebuke even the wind and the waves. But of course, they still can't see who he is. They ask, but they think he's a teacher. And Paul said at this point, so he's not a Christian. He said, well, the disciples are so stupid, aren't they? And I said, yeah. I said, why? He said, well, they can't see who Jesus is. Well, now that's God opening his blind eyes.
Right.
So what I then do is just read the next passage. I said, Paul, let's do it. So we preach Christ, we go identity, mission, or call, can you see? But God does the miracle and opens their eyes. The seed germinates. So just trust the word to do its work. And I think that's what I've given my life to, really, Dan. It's just trying to get people to think, gosh, this is so easy, I could go through Mark's gospel. It's only four words.
Yeah, but let me just pick up on a theme that you have dropped a couple of times, rugby. And I'm a sports enthusiast as well. My field is, I played a lot of everything when I was younger, but I still play tennis quite a lot. And these are my friends. And some of them are believers, and of course, most of them are not. And you can't share the gospel if you don't know any unbelievers. And you have to be in relationships with your neighbors and your coworkers and the people I love my tennis friends. Whether they're believers or not, they're good people, and I love being with them. And then sometimes I get to share my faith with them. So you and I agree that we have to be in relationships with people in order to have that proximity that allows us to have a conversation and allows us to say, let's open the Gospel of Mark or John or Luke or whatever.
Well, Dan, let me push further than that. Honestly, in terms of employing a pastor, I say to people, there are four things he must be able to be doing. Number one, he's got to have a day off. Mm. We don't break God, they break us. Secondly, he's got to have a daily quiet time because you've got to go to the Lord for your strength. Thirdly, he's got to regularly each week spend time with non-Christians. Otherwise, you're just modeling. So with me, I'm in a chess club every Thursday morning.
You don't play rugby anymore?
No, brother. I've got a furniture problem. My chess is in my drawers now. That's my problem.
Right. Anyway, go ahead.
There's just a basic chess club at the school.
Right.
I'm one of the parents that helps run it. But I've got to know people there. There's one guy there who I'm inviting along to stuff. It's just been over 4 years, every Thursday during term time, 8 till 9, chess club.
Yeah.
But the Lord then uses that. But what I'd say, any pastor, we must release them to have time with non-Christian. A number of them are now of the parents that whose kids are in the chess club. They're coming to a quiz night that we've got a Christian support quiz night in a couple of weeks. So you just build the relationships. They know they care about your kids. The fourth one is, can I then open the Bible with a non-Christian? Can you just go through Mark's gospel and just be doing that? And, you know, I've got colleagues and they just don't do that. And I'm going, guys, this is, if we're not modeling it, how do we expect the church family to do it?
Well, the other issue, of course, is that the questions that unbelievers raise are largely the same questions that believers raise. So if you are ministering to unbelievers, you're learning how to minister to your own people. And if they object to some aspect of Christian ethics or the Christian way of life, you almost get a cleaner description of what your own people are laboring with.
Well, I think that's exactly right. It doesn't half affect the preaching.
Yes.
Because you're in reality. You're in the real world with people and seeing how hard it is and seeing the questions. Yeah, no, exactly.
So I have people... again... I'm a professor, but I talk about faith and work a lot and try to train people. And some of the people who are interested in showing their faith in the workplace think that demonstrating your faith or living out your faith in the workplace is simply being an evangelist. And I say, look, can I please ask you to be a good worker first?
Yes.
And to show up and work hard and respect your boss and put in a good day's work and use your skill and advance the good of the entity you're working in. And demonstrate that you care about your neighbor by working hard and well, it'll probably make it easier for you to share your faith. Do you agree with that or disagree with that?
Oh, my brother, I worked at Hewlett-Packard, and there was a very self-righteous colleague I had who was Christian.
Yes.
Who got in at 9:30 on the dot, left at 5 o'clock on the dot, was very self-righteous about church life, but just didn't do a proper day's work. And it was so bad for the gospel. You know, we have to be prepared to... you know, at the appropriate times, work really hard and be self-sacrificing. I think on the whole, Christians pretty much are, brother. I mean, in England, a lot of them, they do work hard. I mean, my job is to get them to talk more, but they are diligent, and I thank God for that. But if you're not diligent, that's just plain ungodly.
I agree. That in the States, I bump into a lot of people that want to evangelize right away, but surely the majority are willing to work hard and not as ready to speak, as your book, Honest Evangelism, so beautifully points out in several ways.
Well, what I would do, though, brother, is that I would early on let people know that they can put me in the church box.
Yeah.
You know, I do at the weekend go to church. I do take that part seriously, because I think if you don't say it, it then can come out. And
yes.
Here's who we are. And I think sometimes it will save us from having to participate in stuff that we just can't. There might be, you know, you go out for a drink with colleagues, but there are times when they say, right, we're now going to a strip club or something, and you say, guys, you know, I say, look, I'm a God botherer. I'm just not doing that, guys. You know, I'm
yeah.
You know, in the rugby club, when I was in the rugby club, I used to say, look, I'm a virgin. You've got to understand that. I'm going home now. You know, you just be self-deprecating.
Yes, yes.
Tell them who you are.
Yep.
And then I don't know about the States, but I always say, start praying for Christmas. Because in England, the easiest environment here is a carol service. I'm not sure in the States, but you know, you can say, look, do you celebrate Christmas? Would you come along with me to something?
Right.
So I always get new workers to aim at saying something at Christmas.
That's a good word. Yeah. Here it's probably Christmas and Easter about equally. That is to say, lots of non-Christians come and they come because they're invited. A recent statistic in the States said that 25% of all atheists go to church on either Christmas or Easter every year.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing? And of course, therefore, let's have the traditional carols that they like. Let's do the hymns they like. But it's an amazing opportunity. And certainly in Europe at the moment, we've had COVID. We've got conflict in Europe and Ukraine. We've got an economic crisis. I mean, people are feeling destabilized.
Right.
And to be able to say, look, my faith is a huge help. I'd love you to come and just come and enjoy a service with me. And then, of course, you know, when it's Ramadan, make sure you give some sweets,
right.
You know, because that's one of the things they do in the evening. And, you know, if it's Bali, be respectful. So over here, I say to people, you know, let's make sure that we respect them. We're totally holding on to the uniqueness of Jesus.
Right.
But they can practice their faith. We want to be listening and thoughtful about that. And then we have an opportunity to speak ourselves.
Thank you. So can we, I want to end with get to know Rico a little bit, okay?
Yes.
So if you could do anything at all for 1 year, something different, money's no object, logistics are no object, everybody's just going to make it happen. What would you do for 1 year?
Oh, brother, I'd lose weight by playing golf.
Okay. All right.
And the other thing I'd do is I'd love to do a year in Afghanistan, just those dear brothers and sisters there. I mean, I've worked in Pakistan. I mean, I don't know how to do it, but just to feel what it was like to be under that sort of pressure. So the two things, one is totally carnal, I'll do in the new creation. The other is these brothers and sisters, you know, I mean.
I love that answer. I don't love golf, the golf answer, but I love the second answer. So
the second,
I think pastors should never play golf because it takes too long, but we're not going to talk about that. What would you like to be celebrating in 5 years?
Brother, I'd love my kids to be really loving Jesus. You know, and that I need that miracle, and I just please pray that I'll live it out and I'll be faithful teaching them. But, you know, we all, and I hope there'll be people listening and your hearts will be breaking over kids, but gosh, we just invest so much. I'd love them just to really be, to love Jesus as I do. Mm-hmm. I'd love that.
Yeah, that's a great answer. Yeah. All right, speaking of love, last question. What do you love the most about the church?
I think it's seeing these people 7 or 8 years after they've been converted, still thrilled with Jesus and following him. You know, that the parable of the sower says we're going to get disappointment. And I think that happens over the first 5 years. But, you know, when they're really stuck in, living differently, loving God's people, loving Christ as the good shepherd, that it's a joyous thing to see.
Yes, it is. Rico, thanks for your time. I really appreciate what you do with your gifts, how you've accepted your calling, and how you are an evangelist and help us think about being an evangelist and encourage us to be a Bible sharer. If nothing else, we can just read the Bible and tell other people about it as we love them. Really glad to have you on our podcast today.
And Dan, if I may say, I've learned from you, I love that phrase about the gap in the gospel. There's this gap, this blindness, but I've never heard it referred to as this gap before. And you're right. There's a gap and we go, don't they get it? And that's a lovely phrase. So I will use that. Thank you very much for that.
I'd be glad to be part of your ministry in some tiny way. Thanks again.
Okay, Brent.
Working with Dan Doriani is a production of the Center for Faith and Work St. Louis. We seek to promote faithfulness in the workplace, in education, in discipleship, and in the stories of believers who've applied their faith at work. If you want to put your faith to work and change your corner of the world, visit our website, the Center for Faith and Work St. Louis. Look for faithandworkstl.org. That's one word. We'll help you start a cohort with like-minded believers who also want to practice their faith at work. This podcast is donor-supported. To keep us going, please donate on our website. Maybe more importantly, you can support us by listening, by subscribing, by sharing, by liking us, by posting us on your favorite platform, or go old school and tell a friend.